matter of if there will be an oil disaster. It's happened. We need to get people's attention. If people choose civil disobedience to get the attention, that is just fine by me. That's how change really happens. That's how society changes, when people have had enough.
Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground, turn the ships around.
Coal, Sacrifice Zones was written, narrated, and produced by Barbara Bernstein. Original music was composed and performed by Barbara Bernstein, Floating Glass Balls, and Anna Fritz.
And turn the ships around. Keep it going. Cascadia.
Special thanks to Dan Sears, Eric DePlace, Carol Newman, Peter Siegel, Steve Early, KMUN Coast Community Radio, Melissa Marslin, Jerry Mayer, Jan Zuckerman, and Bill Bigelow. This program was funded by the Regional Arts and Culture Council and the Puffin Foundation.
Cascadia is a place of great power.
Sacrifice Zones is available on CD from Feather and Fin Productions, P.O. Box 82777, Portland, Oregon 97282. That's Feather and Fin Productions, P.O. Box 82777, Portland, Oregon 97282. CDs are $12. You can also purchase them on our website, mediaprojectonline.org/sacrifice-zones, where you can learn more about holding the thin green line and the struggle to keep fossil fuels in the ground.
We are a people awakening. We are a people reclaiming. We are a people demanding. Turn the ships around.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Good morning. You are tuned in to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned now for Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. It is just a minute and a half after 11 o'clock. This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Chamber Music Northwest, featuring the 2017 Summer Festival starting June 26th. 5 weeks of music, over 30 concerts, more than 60 artists and ensembles, 8 world premieres, 2 theatrical experiences, and a celebration of women composers that spans 9 centuries. More information at cmnw.org.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Dr. Damon Tweedy, is a graduate of Duke Medical School and Yale Law School. He teaches psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center and is a staff physician at the Durham VA Medical Center. Dr. Tweedy has published articles in the Journal of the American Medical Association and the Annals of Internal Medicine, and his columns and op-eds have appeared in the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Raleigh News and Observer, and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's here today to talk about his book, the New York Times bestseller, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. Welcome to Health Watch, Dr. Damon Tweedy.
Thank you.
So you start Black Man in a White Coat talking about one of the allures of pursuing medicine and science was the idea that you could escape race, that these were pursuits that were objective and neutral pursuits in a sense, and that you had quite a wake-up call when you started medical school.
Yes. So this book really looks at that issue from two ways. So one is the perspective of African-American patients, sort of the health problems that we experience. And so when you learn about disease as a first-year student, you hear about diabetes, high blood pressure, you know, cancer, all the different disorders, and you learn about the demographics of them. And whenever we would get to that point in the lecture, the professors would always say that it's more common in black people, and that black people who get the disease do worse. So that was a pretty clear idea that everything wasn't just sort of neutral in a way. And so the book, that's one big theme of the book, is to explore that. The second big theme of the book is to explore how my experience as an African-American physician, medical student, and later physician was unique for my colleagues. So those are really the two layers in which I explore how race is different.
And you say in the book that you came to see that being black is in a way bad for your health. And when you say that some of these conditions are more common, some of them are actually quite a lot more common. You cite infant mortality rate being twice as high, death from prostate cancer being twice as high, obesity rate in black women being twice as high, stroke and high blood pressure twice as high. So a whole order of magnitude higher in some of these conditions.
Yes, and so you know, when you learn about that, so the next question is why, and then from that you want to know why, and then what can you do about it. And so those are the questions that I really didn't feel like I got answers for at that point in my life. And so the book is largely a way to explore that problem. And what I do is I use actual real stories of real people to explore these problems, and you see that there are a lot of different layers to it. I mean, so some of it may be genetic, but there's many other aspects to it. There's whole issues of socioeconomic status and in so many ways that plays out in terms of insurance, health insurance, black people being less likely to have health insurance, being in areas where they don't have access to health care, primary care, or specialty care. All these things really play out. There's another layer in terms of the doctor-patient relationship and how that's a big part in health outcomes. And then thirdly, I look at how individual sort of cultural patterns of diet and exercise also play a huge part. So all those factors are interrelated, and I explore them in the book by using real people's stories to illustrate those problems.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the way race and racism enters the doctor-patient relationship. You cite many disturbing examples when you were a medical student and you were observing patients and how they were being treated by supervisors as they came in and were examined. And one person that sticks out is a patient named Gary who is sure reluctant to take high blood pressure medication before trying some diet and lifestyle modifications. Can you talk a little bit about Gary and the takeaway you had from that experience?
Yeah, sure. So at this point in time, this is my intern year, so I'm, you know, the brand new MD, just trying to sort of fit in and trying to, you know, just survive this. And that's what the internship is largely feels like. So this is a medicine internship, and Gary is this gentleman in his mid-50s, African-American man. He comes into the hospital. It was a public hospital setting, so many of the patients there were poor, and he comes in with chest pain. And, you know, the initial tests rule out having a heart attack. So from there, you know, the next step is, well, you want to do tests to see if he has underlying heart disease, maybe stress tests, those kinds of things, catheterization. And then you want to, you know, start doing what they call secondary prevention, things like taking blood pressure medicine, taking aspirin, not smoking, all those sorts of things. And so everything seemed to be going really well in this case. And then towards the end, you know, they talked about taking a blood pressure medicine, and he wanted to you know, follow diet and exercise, as you said, and really try and address that, because you know there's a lot of research to show that those can make a huge difference in blood pressure. But instead of sort of talking about that and sort of saying, oh, that's an interesting idea, and maybe even encouraging him to optimize that approach, they're very skeptical. So skeptical, in fact, that the doctors actually ended up giving him it's really surprising. So he ended up giving him like a psychiatric label. So here's a guy who comes in the hospital with chest pain, and that's his primary issue, but then comes out of the hospital with a psychiatric diagnosis. Because it seems that the knowledge that he displayed in terms of trying to improve his diet was more than they expected, and it was almost as if he was challenging them. And by doing that, there seemed to be, there was, in their eyes, what I can tell, it seemed like there was something wrong with him if he knew that much about these problems. Like there was some kind of obsessive quality to him in order to know that much. So the clear case of bias, because in many other cases you'd welcome patients that have that sort of knowledge, and you'd be encouraging them to optimize those sorts of approaches.
And you would think that could potentially be one piece of the puzzle for poor health outcomes for black patients if they're receiving that level of care.
Well, it's certainly a factor. I mean, if you think about the idea of having a psychiatric diagnosis, that's certainly not like a benign sort of thing. So if you have that label on your record now, and when you go into future encounters, people are going to be, doctors are going to be aware of that, and then, you know, whether we admit it or not, those sort of things certainly impact how we then subsequently approach patients and their problems. So a person with a psychiatric illness, they come into the hospital, they have a medical issue, they're maybe more likely to be seen as a psychiatric problem, and not, and the medical problem may be less likely to be addressed. So, yeah, so certainly that can be an issue. There's no doubt that that's at least one factor in the bigger picture. I would also say, as a result of that, and actually if you go back further, there's often an issue with African-American patients having a reluctance to even engage in medical care to begin with. So there's a sort of reluctance or hesitance to engage in care because of a history where, you know, black people have been discriminated against in the healthcare arena. And so often you'll see black patients being mistrustful of healthcare. And even when the care is appropriate, they may be more reluctant to go along with the recommendations for that reason. So it's also a very intricate, complicated factor in which how doctor bias can influence health outcomes, as well as patient sort of reluctance or sort of aversion to care can affect health outcomes. So it all kind of interrelates in a sort of really awful way for black people.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to author Dr. Damon Tweedy about his latest book, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. Well, you mentioned reluctance to seek medical care, and there's a real history that creates a real narrative that informs some of these reluctances. Can you talk a little bit about some of the history for African Americans around medicine in the United States that leads to people avoiding getting medical care?
Well, yes. I mean, I think if you go back, 50 years ago, let's just use that as a nice marker, because I think 50 years ago was sort of right in the height of the civil rights movement, when you had the Voting Rights Act and things like that being passed. So it's sort of in the sort of apex of the civil rights movement. So 50 years ago, that's when hospitals were just starting to integrate, because, you know, the Civil Rights Act was passed the year before, 64, and so many hospitals are segregated, and patients, black people, were treated on wards where there's clearly inferior care. In some cases, they were denied treatment. Now, this seems like a long time ago, but if you think about the life of people who are around, many of these people are still living now and have passed on that sort of history, you know, down to, you know, people in my generation. So it's a real history. There's also during that time, there was the famous Tuskegee experiment was still ongoing. So that took place between, you know, 1940s or so and early 1970s. It didn't stop until 1972. In that case, you had men with syphilis in the South who were actually they're known to have syphilis. There's treatments available for it, but they were basically being deceived because the experimenters wanted to follow sort of the natural history of what syphilis would do. And so they picked this sort of population of unsuspecting people to experiment upon. These are all black men in this case. So you have this history. And so, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there are many other examples along those same lines. And so that in modern times, I think, is really still impacts healthcare to the extent that many African Americans are wary of healthcare treatment.
And how much is this history actually taught in medical school? Are white and black medical students getting this history when they're learning how to do doctor-patient relations?
I think it's covered. You know, here's the thing. So as I can recall, when I started medical school, I don't recall that being covered. So I would say no to that back then. I would say that now, yeah, I'm involved in a doctor-patient introduction doc course at Duke, and I know that they do talk about that. I think some students have a hard time sort of capturing what that would have to do with now. It seems like a long time, because, you know, a 20-something-year-old student 50 years ago seems like a really, really long time ago. Like, what would that have to do with now? And so I think some students grapple with that. So I try to impress upon them, the idea of how, you know, the past certainly informs the present in so many different ways, not just with race, but with all sorts of other issues that we have in our society. And, you know, and so I try to impress that upon them and sort of see how that can play out, how that can impact with something you see now in everyday life. You may have an African-American patient under your care now who is questioning the treatment for diabetes, even though, say, you know, a metformin drug or something like insulin is obviously standard of care. They may really question whether or not they're receiving some ways inferior care, and a lot of that is still rooted in things that took place in the past. So I really try to stress that now. So I think there is progress in terms of teaching that, but there's still a way to go.
I really love how, Dr. Tweedy, how you weave in some of your own personal experiences as well. And one of them that sticks out for me, too, is when you go in to get your knee examined and you have this very bipolar experience in the doctor's office as a patient. Can you talk a little bit about that exam?
Yeah, sure. So that was actually included in the same chapter where we talk about the gentleman named Gary. So here I'm in my early 30s, and it's about 10 years ago now, and I had knee pain, and I went to an urgent care clinic because it wasn't getting better, and I didn't think I could wait long enough to see an orthopedic doctor, but it's like, oh, you know, I'm off this thing. Let me just go and get it checked out, make sure there's nothing really wrong because it wasn't getting better. So I went to an urgent care clinic, and so I came from home. I'd been working outside, and so I was dressed in a very casual kind of way. And then I went to the clinic, and the doctor, when I went to the exam, the doctor never looked at me at first. Looked at my knee, but never looked at me in the face. Looked at my knee, but didn't actually examine my knee. So it was really just sort of an eye test. And he had me stand up and down, but never actually touched my knee or examined in that way, nor did he really look at me or engage with me in any kind of, you know, conversation. And then he was ready to just sort of send me out without to say I was fine. And as a doctor, I knew, well, you know, there's probably more that should have been done, could have been done kind of thing. And so I alluded to some medical terms to make him realize that, you know, I kind of knew what I was talking about a little bit. It's not normally how I approach things, but that was, I felt like I needed to in that instance. And suddenly the doctor switched, you know, like I said, a total 180. Suddenly he looked at my eye, looked me in the eye, started to talk to me, engage with me, was suddenly interested in me as a person. And then he did a physical exam. And then said, oh, you know, we should get an x-ray. So it was almost like a whole different line of level of care, completely different care, not even just a different level of care, actually different care. And it was almost like being two different people. It was sort of this illustration of how, on one hand, I'm just dressed in a certain way. I can be perceived as, you know, just this random black guy. Who knows what other stereotypes may have. I can't get into his mind and know what exactly he was thinking. But then I know suddenly once I was being realized I was another colleague, it was suddenly like everything had changed and I was two different people. Hmm. And so that was just sort of another illustration of how differently things can play out in a clinical exam encounter.
Are you familiar with the poet Claudia Rankine, Dr. Tweedy?
I know the name, but I'm not familiar with this particular work.
It just made me think of something that she mentions in her book Citizen, and I'm curious your thoughts on it. She talks a lot about microaggressions, which she calls very small acts of racism that are happening even among friends and colleagues that don't have poor intentions. But she also ponders in this book as a poet whether just navigating microaggressions on a day-to-day level could lead to adverse health outcomes. And I was just curious of what your thoughts were on that. I mean, obviously, there's a socioeconomic aspect. There's the poor care. There's the history of medical abuse historically that leads to distrust of getting standard of care today. But could there also just be that day-to-day stress of navigating these things that may or may not be happening that are small but very, in a cumulative sense, quite large?
Sure, I think so. I think to the extent that, you know, there's because one of the things that you sort of experience is like when someone when you describe one of these microaggressions, part of this mental gymnastics you go through is, well, is this really something racial or is it not, or is this just like this person having a bad day? You know, you sort of spend the energy trying to navigate that part first, and so that requires a certain level of energy, right? And then there's the next layer. Well, if it was just a racial slight. What should I do about it? Should I tell this person? Should I not?
Exactly.
Is it worth to pick the battle of the day, or should I fight another day? You know, instead of all these other sorts of mental gymnastics you go through. So in a cumulative way, yeah, this certainly can definitely impact you. I mean, in the book, I talk about several of those sorts of situations. I mean, for instance, I mean, something... I mean, it ranges from like things like this perception of you being a threat. So that's the most, you know, or someone leaves the elevator when you come in, or crosses the street when you are on their side. It's those things that I've certainly experienced. So that's because that level of sort of microaggression, right? And then there's also the idea of things like I've experienced like with sports. So I'm an African American man. I'm tall. There's this perception that I play basketball, you know, and I do love basketball. And so in some ways, sometimes it's fine. Someone asks you to play basketball, no big deal. But then there are other times when someone will then take it another step further, and then they'll assume that because you like basketball, then you're dumb, or that you can only play basketball. And so there were cases where patients would say, well, you know, well, what are you doing here? You should be playing basketball, and, you know, I don't think you need to be a doctor. And they would say, not in a joke, but in a very serious way. So, you know, is it in that particular case, do you spend the energy to sort of assert yourself or not? You know, so all those things certainly can add up.
And you mentioned some really horrifying instances of you walking into a room as either a doctor or a medical student and people thinking you're the janitor, for instance.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. So it's right. So it gets even more more so involved in what I described before. Yeah, so there's that one opening scene in the book where I'm a medical student, and this is a professor. So in this case, it's even more serious because the professor is someone who, you know, it's not just a random person you're going to see and not never see again. It's like someone who's really has influence over you, right? And so, which is very different than some of a random person on the street. So in this case, in the book, the professor, I walk into the classroom, and this is early in my first year. So I'm already feeling, you know, that sort of first-year medical student anxiety heightened by the fact that I'm an African-American man, and I come from a lower-income family, and all these other, and my classmates have much more well-to-do backgrounds. So all those things are already playing in my mind, but then I walk into the classroom, professor's like, oh, he comes up in a sort of angry kind of way, irritated actually, and, you know, are you here to fix the lights? You know, I called about this last week. Why didn't you do it yet? Sort of thing. And so I was taken aback. And I was thinking about, well, you know, did I dress the right way? Did I do something wrong? You go again, you go through this sort of internal dialogue. What should I do about it? And so, yeah, so that's an obvious case of how, you know, these sort of situations play out and can impact you in an adverse way as an African American. Because there's a mental energy required to do that. If you spend so much energy on that, it can also impact your performance academically and professionally as well. So there's so many other costs to it. Even in beyond the sort of potential, you were talking about potential health problems, there's a sort of performance aspect to it as well. So a lot of factors at work.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Health Watch, and we're talking today to Dr. Damon Tweedy about his book, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. Well, I believe in your 30s, you yourself get a diagnosis of high blood pressure and then start to notice some of your own resistances about seeking the standard of care around a treatment for high blood pressure. Can you talk us through some of what you went through internally around that?
Yeah, this is a really important thing that sort of topic that kind of is weaved throughout the whole book. And so, as a first-year medical student, so this is that time when you're learning about all the health problems that African-American people experience. I actually had some of my family, my grandmother actually died during my first year of medical school. She had, you know, a lot of these same problems, high blood pressure, that wasn't adequately treated. She had a series of strokes, ended up having vascular dementia. So she had these sorts of problems. But me, about 6 months later, I'm 23 years old, so I'm still very young. I'm very athletic at that time. Played sports several times a week, was in normal weight and all those sorts of things. But then I get diagnosed with high blood pressure. One day we're practicing as medical students, you know, how to examine each other, and my blood pressure is kind of through the roof. And I get it checked out a few weeks later by a family doctor on campus. And yeah, so my blood pressure was really high. And not only was it elevated, but there was also some signs that I had some kidney disease, actually, as well. At least early signs that I may be heading in that direction. And so a lot of things were happening. And here I am, a very young, healthy guy. And so I'm a medical student, so I have a lot of knowledge about what to do, right? And so more so than the average person does. Nonetheless, I still found myself really struggling, and the book kind of talks about this in and out throughout the book as weaved throughout the story. You know, the struggles that I had to sort of address these problems, and a big part is diet. When you talk about high blood pressure in particular, I was eating even though I had my weight was normal, I was eating all kinds of really bad foods. You know, eat a whole pizza, eat several hot dogs. You know, just eating fast food every day, that sort of thing. And I wanted to change my diet. And I did initially, but then I would kind of go back and forth in these sort of yo-yo cycling ways. And, of course, change is hard for everybody. But for me, it was sort of an added layer to it. It was almost as if, you know, I'd grown up in a certain kind of environment, working class, all-black community, and eating one type of food and then changing from another, it felt more like more than just simply changing your lifestyle. It was almost like an identity issue. It's almost like you identify a certain way of eating, like you identify certain healthy foods, like, you know, eating salads and drinking bottled water and low fat yogurt. You identify that as white, and so there's almost like a resistance to changing. And so it was almost as if it wasn't so much that the change of food represented a hard thing in terms of texture or taste, but it was more along the lines of what it meant in terms of my identity. And so that's a real struggle. And so that's something that, you know, many African-American patients I've seen and talked to understand that. And so I think if you're seeing a patient in the clinic and they have high blood pressure, it's not as simple as saying, oh, well, we try this blood pressure, well, let's switch to this other one. I mean, I think it also can be more along the lines of, like, giving the patient room to discuss, well, you know, hey, what might be getting in the way of us reaching our goals? And giving the patient a sort of open space to talk about an issue like that. And for me, that was a big deal. Once I was able to recognize that for what it was, I was really able to overcome it. And so now my blood pressure is normal. don't need blood pressure medicine or anything, and I have very normal blood pressure. And I'm actually in not as good a shape as I was back then. And so it's an interesting example of kind of working through these issues.
Well, to quote you from Black Man in a White Coat, you say at one point, poverty, poor access to medical care, and unhealthy lifestyle choices, to name a few, are certainly valid. But the longer I've practiced medicine, the more I've come to appreciate a factor that is less obvious, the lack of Black doctors. Tell us, how scarce are Black doctors today?
Yeah, so that's another big piece of the book, right, about what's unique about my experience as an African-American doctor. And so, you know, in the general population, it's about 13% of the population is African-American. Now, that number is actually considerably higher in many of the sort of main academic medical centers where doctors are trained. So if you talk about, like, for instance, Duke is in Durham, North Carolina, which is like 40% Black. Johns Hopkins is in Baltimore, where it's 60% Black. You can name the school, Penn is in Philadelphia, where it's like 50% Black. So all these, a lot of these major hospitals are in places where there's a really large Black population, even much larger than the national average. But even there, the number of African-American physicians is about 4%. So we're talking about nationwide 13% population, 4% among physicians. And again, those numbers are even more dramatic when you talk about many of the places where doctors are trained. So that's a real stark disconnect here.
And is this a scenario that's worsening, or is it improving with time?
It's plateaued. And so there was a period in which, so like, if you go back to like the 60s, the numbers were like 1 or 2%, and all those doctors were being trained at two medical schools, Howard, which is a Black school in D.C., and Meharry, which is a historically Black school in Tennessee. And that's where they were all being trained, like back in the mid-60s. But now, during the 70s and 80s, there was a significant increase in African-American doctors. This is largely due to the sort of the end of the civil rights movement, and affirmative action was really strong during that period of time. But the numbers have actually sort of plateaued over the last 20 years, particularly in African-American men. So the numbers of African-American women doctors have still gone up, but the African-American men, the number of doctors, there's actually a recent study that came out about 2 months ago by the Association of American Medical Colleges, which is called the AAMC. And the numbers have actually plateaued in African-American men going back to about 1980, so the last 35 years. Whereas in every other subgroup, the numbers have gone up significantly because the population has gone up significantly. So the population of the general population as well as the population of doctors, the one exception was African-American men.
And in terms of a difference between subgroups also, the vast majority of Black doctors are women, which isn't true in other groups necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. So about two-thirds of the African-American medical students now are women, whereas among other groups it's more like, 50-50 or 55-45 men. But among Black women, it's 2-1. So as an African-American male doctor myself, I'm certainly definitely an outlier in the medical world.
And is there any movement that's going on today that people can hook into around making medical school more accessible for the African-American medical student?
There's several programs. I mean, it's kind of taken place in a hodgepodge sort of way, but yes, I mean, for instance, Duke is part of a consortium of about 6 schools, I think, on the East Coast where they have summer programs. It's called the Summer Minority. I'm blanking on the exact what it stands for, but it's basically a summer minority program for medical and dental students, aspiring medical and dental students who are African-American. And it brings students to campus and it gives them a feel for the whole idea of what it takes to apply to medical school, what it's like to interview for medical school, what courses do you need, how do you study for the MCAT, all those really sort of nuts and bolts kinds of things that so many African-American students just really don't have or sort of miss out on. So I think that's a big part of the puzzle. But I think an even bigger piece kind of goes back to bigger issues in society. We're talking about issues like educational access, quality of education at much younger ages. Even to even get in the pipeline to become a medical student, you have to have had a certain start at a younger age before you even get to college. And so that's a huge issue. And I think there's this really big piece of sort of perception in society. I think that sort of the lanes for African-American men are so narrow. Like, if I think about my childhood and so many people I know, it's like, well, you always hear about so many Black men that are in the criminal justice system and all that sort of, also that sorts of thing. And then the Black men who do succeed, it's like, well, they're either athletes or they're sort of some kind of entertainer. And so there's just sort of like this idea, and I think it starts from the top of society and it sort of filters down to the community, where it really limits the aspirations of African-American men in particular. So that's a real issue that we're struggling with. And part of my goal in writing the book was to sort of help combat some of that.
And it's interesting. So you're a rare African-American male doctor, but you're also a psychiatrist, which is even probably rare in this sense. And you talk a little bit about some of the challenges of mental health within the African American community, and particular biases towards seeking mental health. Can you touch briefly on that as well?
Yeah, so that's a whole other layer, right? So when I went into psychiatry, just like when I went to medical school, I wasn't really thinking about race so much. But once you get there, you just sort of see how it plays out. And so in many ways, African American, there's just two issues really. So African American people often are have less access to care, just like in the medical realm, and in psychiatry, sometimes even more stark when you, because so much of it is based on insurance, and so like if you in the kind of care you can get, it really is different whether you have insurance or not, and particularly in psychiatry, it's really stark. There are a couple of issues that come with psychiatry. So one is this issue of what they call misdiagnosis. You often find African American people are more likely to have a more serious diagnosis being given to them. There's a whole line of research that goes into that. And so they're more likely to receive more serious medications and less likely to receive psychotherapy as an option versus sort of the hardcore heavy-duty medications. That's one big component of it. And I think a lot of that is just sort of the idea of a doctor and patient not being able to relate to each other. And I think if you can't relate and communicate to the patient well, it's always easiest to give the medication. And so that's one big part of it. I think another aspect of it is another history of African American in the community having really sort of a fear of mental health treatment. And again, there's a bad history with how the mental health treatment has stereotyped and perceived African Americans. But there's also this perception among African Americans that mental health is something that's a luxury that's afforded for white people in a way. And it sounds bad, but that's kind of how it often plays out. And there's this idea that it can be handled within the community, within church, and those sorts of things. And so there's also this sort of aversion in some ways to mental health care. So again, you have these two different things that are working together to sort of make the outcomes worse for African Americans.
And finally, how has Black man in a white coat been received among your colleagues in the medical community and patients?
I think really good feedback. I mean, there's certainly people, whenever you talk about race, there's some people who are always going to bristle at that. I mean, that's just inevitable. And I've had some people on the other side where they felt like I wasn't political enough and calling things out even more than I could have. So I think there's some of that, but overall my perception has been very positive. I didn't have been at Duke, so I was worried about how Duke would perceive it, because I'm still at Duke and I've been here for many years. I had an event last week and they were very enthusiastic about the event. It was well attended. People were very receptive to this message. And I think that the thing that I appreciate most is when people, I got a, a